And welcome to Veterans Radio this evening. I am Jim Fossone. I'm your officer of the deck today on WAM 1600 Talk Radio in Ann Arbor. We've got a great couple of interviews for you, one with a local entrepreneur who's cranking out Jarhead Salsa. I think you'll enjoy this story and how the recipe came to be and where you can get locally made Jarhead Salsa. And the second interview will be with Tom Tudor, who is a historian, speaker, nationally known regarding Arlington National Cemetery and guarding the tomb of the unknown soldier. But first, let's thank our sponsors. We want to thank American House Westland at 1660 South Benoy Road in Westland, Michigan, for taking care of our seniors and our veterans. So if you have needs for those types of assisted living services, you can contact American House at 734-961-4782. And please tell our friends at American House that Veterans Radio sent you to inquire about their available services and what they do for our veterans. We also want to thank our sponsor, Legal Help for Veterans, which deals with veterans' disability claims, both new and appeals. And you can reach Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. So this is always the point where we tell you there's a lot of information packed into this hour. We hope you can sit back and listen to it all. But if you can't, you can always find it on the archives at veteransradio.net. And we always want you to follow along with what we're doing by staying with us on Facebook or keeping in contact with us on the web. Send us your comments about additional shows or programs, people we ought to interview. We love that kind of information, and we love bringing it to you on WAM 1600 AM radio out of Ann Arbor. So next up is the whole discussion about Jarhead Salsa. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Tom Smith. Tom's in business with his son. You're going to get a kick out of this. These guys are running a company called Jarhead Salsa. And our veteran radio listeners can certainly picture this at the moment. Tom, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thanks, Jim. Good to be with you.
Well, this is you find yourself in a second career here after retiring out of General Motors and going into business with your son, David Smith, to set up Jarhead Salsa. But before we get into that, I think let's talk a little bit about your Marine here. David's working at the moment, so he wasn't able to join us. But tell us about why David joined the military and a little bit about his military experience.
Okay, well, Dave wasn't ready for college. That was his thought after he got out of high school. He went to Flint Powers. And so he decided to go into the Marines and just came home one day and said, "Dad, Mom, I want to sign up for the Marines." And I believe at that time he needed to have our signature to go along with it. But after we got over the shock, we were okay with it. And he said he wanted to learn to go be a cook, and that he had worked with the recruiter, and the recruiter said he could go ahead and do that. And he always, as a kid, he liked to be around the kitchen, and so he worked a deal out with the recruiter. He wanted to go to California. He wanted to, head out to Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego. So I think he signed up for an extra 2 years. And so he went ahead, and that took him, he got out of boot camp. And first time we saw him after whatever it was, the 12 weeks in there, he came out singing a cadence. And it was great. It went, "Mama, mama, can't you see what the Corps has done for me? Shave my head and shave my face, maybe part of the human race."
And you and your wife said, "Oh my God, I can't even." What'd they do to this kid? He's so squared away.
And next, after a leave, he went over to Camp Lejeune, and that's where the Marines had cooking school. And he went through his cooking school in Camp Lejeune, and then came back to Camp Pendleton and started his career off cooking. Shortly thereafter, he ended up getting transferred to 29 Palms. And when Operation Desert Shield started, he was the first group to go, the first group of any U.S. military to end up in over, and they were first night sleeping on the beach in Saudi Arabia. And before we had the big buildup of troops, they were like the speed bump for the Iraqi army. But
well, all those Marines are riflemen, as we all know, but we also know they got to wake up in the morning, you got to feed them. So we're going to get back. We're going to get back to David's experience in the field with food service for the Marines. But before we do that, I think it's important to point out that your family has David's brothers have had a real commitment to service to the country. Tell us about both of them.
Okay. Well, our middle son, Alan, served in the Coast Guard, and you know, he went to boot camp in Cape May, and of all the places you could get stationed in the United States for the Coast Guard, he ended up getting stationed at a buoy tender in Lake Charlevoix, the Acacia, the USS Acacia.
We call that good duty if you can get it.
It was good duty, and in a second regard, that he met his wife when he was stationed in Charlevoix. And her family had a Coast Guard background. In fact, one of her, I believe it was her grandfather, passed away saving a life at a life-saving station in Charlevoix. And so, you know, she ended up marrying another Coast Guardsman. So the Coast Guard runs deep in both sides of the family. You might get a little interruption back because we're driving, and we have their two-year-old daughter with us, our granddaughter, Isla.
Well, she's being great so far. Let me just, before we move on to your other son, I wanted to mention that you had explained to me that Alan, while serving in the Coast Guard, also had a deployment to Haiti when that was a hot mission down there. So
true.
You get a lot of experience in the Coast Guard. So let's go on and talk about your Army son.
Okay, our youngest son is an Army Ranger currently serving at Fort Benning, and he's in the 75th Ranger Regiment, and he's in a sergeant in charge of supply and logistics, and he is in charge of the inventory of sensitive equipment, millions of dollars worth of inventory down at Fort Benning, and the Army turned this kid's life around. He was struggling as a civilian early in life. Some of his friends had talked him out of going into the military, and now he went in later in life. He was 32 years old, and we were just hoping he made it through boot camp, and he did so well in boot camp they gave him a Ranger contract. And it was too long after that that you know, as he got through Ranger training, he was promoted to sergeant. So this kid, you know, we think the Army's turned his life around.
Well, you're clearly proud of all of your children, and they've all served the country in different capacities. And I think it's important that folks understand that background as we turn our attention to talking about Jarhead Salsa, because you come at this with, you know, respect, if you will. This isn't a joke. This isn't a novelty item. So tell us a little bit about how Dave first came up with his recipe, or why he even came up with a recipe for salsa.
Well, he was feeding 3,000 Marines a day at Camp Pendleton, the Marine Corps base in Southern California, and he didn't like the salsa the government provided for the taco bar in his food service. You know, he was the gunny, and he had took pride in in the food he served. And one of the things you didn't want to do was ever go through his chow line, and he would have, you know, new boots that would say, "What is this, SH?" And he'd grab him by the collar and he said, "First off, this is not, you know, what you said." And he made sure they had respect for what he was doing back there. But no, he tried to put the best food out he can. And so he spent, when he didn't like the salsa the government was providing for the taco bar in his food service, he took a year experimenting, and he came up with this recipe. And when he put it out, his fellow Marine said, "Hey, Smitty, you Mexican?" Because it was so good. And he said, he is not, obviously. And so it ended up being a hit. Well, we would be out visiting him. You know, with his 20 years, we spent about 2 years of our life, if you add up all the weeks that we were on vacation, out in Southern California at the Marine Corps base. So put the sauce out, and we started bringing it home. And it was such a hit when we brought it home. Like, my wife brought it into work, and there was a doctor there that loved it so much, he bought $3,000 of it over the next couple of years. And he put the money in the bank, and when he retired in 2008, that was the seed money we used to start the company.
Budding entrepreneurial stories that a lot of military guys go through, where they use those to improve the salsa being supplied to the troops. And I saw somewhere that Dave estimated he made more than 5 million meals during his 20-year career.
Yeah, that's what we figured out. He was feeding 3,000 Marines a day and doing it for most of the 20 years. And when you do out the calculations, it was 5 million meals. And so we just use that as a, you know, a source of pride of what he accomplished. And I'm telling you, as if there's anybody out there was a military cook, knows he got up at some ungodly hours to make sure, because, you know, he had to drive in sometimes from San Diego, where he lived with a couple other gunnies, and get ready to cook or have the meal ready when everybody was ready to eat in the morning. And so he just got up at crazy hours for a number of years. And, you know, I wanted to just talk about, okay, so gunny is cooking right now. You know, that's what he does. And he's creative with food, but, you know, God gives us all different talents. And, you know, I went on to get my MBA at Michigan State. And so with what I had learned in marketing at GMI and Michigan State, I was able to help him put together a marketing approach. And so it's like in the family, we all use our different talents to make this happen.
Let me elaborate on that a little bit, because I think a lot of guys have a spark of an idea, but they don't have all the tools they need to move it along. The reason Dave could move this to the next level is not because he had the business chops necessarily to do it, but that you brought a lot to the table, the rest of the family brought a lot to the table to help him with this idea. So talk a little bit how early on you, Tom Smith, and your son David said, "Hey, I think we can do more with this," and how everybody's helped out in that regards.
Okay, well, we started out at the BFW Hall in Grand Blanc Township, Michigan. And, we just outgrew the size of the kitchen after a while, but we were making 40 pints a week. And our first big break is an orchard in the area in the fall started letting us come down and sell our salsa there. And so all of a sudden, when people started tasting this, you know, the reaction was just great. And one of the things I learned in business school is this was a premium salsa. This is not pureed tomatoes and salt. There's orange peppers, red peppers, yellow peppers, green peppers. We bring up lemon and lime juice from Florida. So it's got a beautiful color. And then after the eye appeal, when you put it in your mouth, you get four different taste sensations at once, because it's tart from the lemon and lime juice. It's sweet from the Michigan sugar. Then we've got the Gunny's recipe is cumin, garlic, chili powder, and cilantro. And then we've got a little bit of heat. And because we tell people we can't serve anything weak with a picture of a Marine on it. And so you taste all four flavors at once, and people just have this reaction. Well, we give it to them in a great big this is a nacho tray like you would get at a ballpark, and we give them a dollop of our queso, our salsa mixed with cheese, and then some salsa and our two types of chips. And we just tell people, we give out generous samples because we have highly addictive products. And I just tell them it's good marketing. So we got a premium product. We sell at a premium price. We get $7 a pint, and then that gives us the margin to be able to donate to the veterans. And then we sell in farmers markets where people are coming to look for something special. And we're not in a lot of stores, and then we give a premium promotion, that generous sample. So that's a little bit of that's kind of in a nutshell our marketing.
And who's doing the cooking here? Who's overseeing the quality control and dealing with the regulations and all of that sort of stuff?
Well, I had a background in quality control from General Motors. I helped Buick Motor Division and Buick City control quality. So I have that background. But then my wife, we call her our not-so-silent partner. She's got a background in nursing and also in quality and cleanliness. And then, of course, the gunny, he made that 5 million meals, and there was never an incident with any of his food for 20 years. So we've got a pretty good, solid background. I think we made the Michigan Department of Agriculture feel pretty comfortable when they granted us our license. You know, we've been licensed now since 2009. And then Gunny learned, you know, food service quality. And so they call it a HACCP plan. It's a control plan to make sure that your food, you do all the preemptive things to make sure that your food is safe. So we've been able to continue on into and now my wife and I work together and we can our salsa. And she had a little bit of home training in canning, but we took a course from University of California, San Diego, and then we have a professor at Michigan State that helped us get our recipe together of the right heat and time to can our salsa and Bloody Mary mix.
Well, there's a lot of pieces to running a successful business, and I think at times it can be overwhelming. Now, the Gunny retired in 2008, and in 2009, you were able to get your business license out of the state, and you've been at this for 9 years. So talk a little bit about how that progression in terms of the volume you're selling now, the extra products you've added in over those 9 years, how you grow a business, if you will, and how.
Okay, well, we ran into a guy that was a cook chef in Chicago, and he helped us develop some new products like the queso and got us into chips. It's no one person, you know, no one person has all the gifts they need to get this up and running, but you know, if I don't know how to do something, you know, I'm not afraid. I got to give some credit to Michigan State University. Whenever we've called them to need some help, and they have a special department and unit that helps food business in Michigan get started. And they've been and I'm a Spartan grad, and so they've been instrumental in helping us too. So, you know, if you don't know how to do something, you just, you know, go find someone that can help you out, and we've been able to do that. I had a brother-in-law that's since passed, Sammy's brother, that worked as a beer distributor, and he helped us out with, you know, our getting our warehouse organized and having our records on how much we sold so that we were able to kind of project. But we went from the 40 pints a week, and then we got in the Grand Blanc Farmer's Market, and we started the Durand Farmers Markets, and then we got up into the Tri-Cities Midland Farmers Market, and we're still at these markets every week. And we grew into the Tri-Cities area, and then the big thing came. All of a sudden, Eastern Market recruited us to come down there, and my first reaction, they wanted $1 million worth of liability insurance. And that just seemed like a lot for a small company. So I kind of put it off for a year and a half. And then you start to get more confident. And I figured it was time. So I went down to PM this time, and Eastern Market is 20,000 people coming through there on a weekend. And that's where we ran into one of the reporters from the Free Press about 3 weeks ago that loved our story. And the next thing you know, we had that big article Sunday in the Free Press. And our phones just been ringing off the hook since then, because we ship anywhere in the U.S. And so, we've been getting a ton of orders to gotta apply our shipping guy with more salsa. And we got to go down on Thursday and start canning more salsa.
Well, and one of the things that I saw, you've moved from those 40 pints a month to now you're doing, what, 1,000 pints a week?
When all the markets are up and running in the summer, and you know that the farmers markets are seasonable, and there are some events like Fish Sandwich Festival in Bayport or the Capital Market on Lansing, Woods and Water out in Imlay City. We've got a gun and knife show coming up in Grand Rapids. When we get the right combination of events and farmers markets and stores, we've got a few stores, then we hit that number. We hit 1,000 pints of salsa, 600 pints of queso, and about 800 bags of chips in a week. But we try to not make any more than we can salsa and queso than we can sell in that week. And we pride ourselves on freshness. So we try to sell out every week, and then we build our inventory back up for the next week.
Well, I'm sure the Gunny wouldn't have it any other way, because he delivered fresh food, fresh taste to his Marines for 20 years, and I'm sure he wouldn't have it any other way. We're talking to Gunny's dad, Tom Smith, partner in Jarhead Salsa. Before we run out of time, Tom, I want you to talk a little bit about where folks can learn more about Jarhead Salsa and how they can order some if they want to give it a try.
Okay, well, we have an honor system ordering where you call me, okay? It's still a company, and we try to not lose the personal touch. And we felt the Internet, we try not to have any monthly fixed costs because, I've seen that cause a lot of businesses trouble. So we don't have an Internet page, but we got a Facebook page where you can keep in touch. We post on the Facebook page very frequently. It's Jarhead Salsa at Facebook. And then the other thing is my phone number is 810-874-1062, and you call me to order. And the way that process works is you tell us what you want, we ship it out, and then when we've got a tracking number, then I call back and collect. And that way we try to get the cheapest shipping price we can get. That way we don't overcharge for shipping. We just charge the actual shipping amount. It's family business.
Well, and that's the beauty of this. And I think the idea that Gunny developed this recipe, everybody seemed to like it, and this creates an opportunity to have the entire family involved in a business that they can take pride in. And it also allows the business, Jarhead Salsa, to give back to veterans groups. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay, we've got three veterans charities. And the first one is the national one. It's the Gary Sinise Foundation. And the way we do our charity is we pay all our bills at the end of the month. And whatever's left, we take 10% right off the top before anybody gets paid anything, and give that to the veterans. And we started out with that process. That's right out of the Bible, to give back 10%, and that's what we do. And so we started out with writing a check for $4, and now when we give it to our different charities, it's got a couple of zeros behind it. And then our second charity is that Odd Fellows scholarship fund for Sons and Daughters of Veterans, and that's the one that's located in Davison. And our last charity is the Impact Pregnancy Center in Flint, Michigan, because we have so many kids conceived out of wedlock in Flint that if a family with a problem pregnancy can prove they have a veteran in the family, we make sure the baby's born and not aborted, and we support it for its first 3 years. And that one has a special place in our heart.
Well, those are great ways in which you help, the business helps the larger veteran community and allows you to make those sort of choices based on the profitability that you generate. And obviously you focus on, hey, I want to generate some profits here. I want to be able to give to my charities, and I want to obviously pay our people. So it's a very interesting business, and I don't think you can get more direct and hands-on to order Jarhead Salsa other than by calling Tom Smith at 810-874-1062.
Jim, but the best thing, we like to get you fresh salsa, okay? And if for those in the Detroit area, Eastern Market on Saturday, and not only we can get you salsa we made that week, and it's not sitting on a store shelf, and we have package deals where if you buy more than 2 pints, you get a discount. So that if they can make it down to Eastern Market, that's the best way to get it.
And are you in a specific shed that they ought to look for?
Shed 2.
Okay.
And we've got a great sign with the Gunny's face. I was going to say that earlier about marketing. A Marine and Dress Blues is one of the most recognized brands in the world.
Well, we want to thank you, Tom, Jarhead Salsa.
So I can verify that Jarhead Salsa is extremely tasty. I went down to Eastern Market, picked up a couple of cases, handed them out for gifts during the holidays, and if you do that, you're going to help support a veteran business. And right after this, the news here on WHAM 1600, we'll talk to Tom Tudor about Arlington National Cemetery. Welcome back to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone, your officer of the deck, here on WHAM 1600 AM. We're glad you're listening to Veterans Radio. You can send me an email at jim@veteransradio.net to offer up any story ideas. Our next interview is with Tom Tudor, a nationally known speaker, historian about Arlington and the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and we'll get to that right after this brief message from one of our sponsors.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We are pleased to welcome to Veterans Radio today Tom Tudor, a Army veteran, but more importantly, a speaker and presenter on Arlington National Cemetery and the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Tom, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you, Jim. Glad to be part of your broadcast today.
Started in the military back in the 70s, I think it was. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your military career, and that'll lead us right into your service at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier.
Well, I was in the pre-lottery draft. I went to my physical in March of 68, just weeks after the end of the Tet Offensive, and was called up in June, on June 10th of 68, and inducted and went to basic combat training at Fort Bliss, Texas, in June, July, and August, a delightful place to spend the summer on the Mexican border there right near El Paso. And then, like anybody who had some college, I'd had 2 years at the University of Iowa, and like anybody who'd had some college or had a good degree, actually, a lot of guys who were in my draft call from the draft board in Des Moines had lost their student deferments as they graduated. So we had a lot of college graduates who were going in. And so, like anybody who had some college, I got sent to infantry AIT. And I think the Army's thinking there was, we have all these kids with some college or college degrees. Well, if we send them to infantry, maybe the light will go on and they'll volunteer for OCS, because there was great need for junior officers in the field in Vietnam at the time. And I went to Fort Ord, California in late August of 68, and then, of course, did infantry AIT there, at Fort Ord. The second week I was there, recruiters from the Old Guard, the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, which has been in existence in one form or another since 1784, the Old Guard, which does all the ceremonial stuff for the Army in Arlington and the D.C. area, they had senior NCOs out recruiting, and we went to a meeting and saw a film of the Tomb Guards, of the caisson platoons, and of the U.S. Army drill team, and then if we wanted to volunteer, fill out a form, and went and presented that to the E7 or E8 in his dress blues, and he said, "Stand at attention, execute an about face, and walk away." So they were looking to see if we were symmetrical, if we weren't limping, or if we had our legs were the same length and our shoulders and ears the same height and all that stuff. And I didn't hear anything for 7 weeks. And when orders came down at the end of AIT, I remember we were out on bivouac, and they read them. And most of the guys went to Material Assistance Command, MACV, Vietnam. And I was the only one out of 220 guys in that training company that went to Fort Myer, Virginia.
And it's amazing, isn't it, Tom, how one little, in this instance, an set of orders, how one little thing has really shaped your life, isn't it?
It's changed the whole thing.
So you went on and trained and ultimately became a sentinel and then relief commander at the Arlington, at Arlington's Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. But for our listeners, explain what a sentinel is, and then explain what the relief commander status is.
Sure. The tomb guards are in something that would be, I suppose, akin to a platoon, although we were much smaller than that in that time than a platoon. We were more like three squads, but all infantry, of course, because that was an infantry unit. The entire battalion at the time was the 1st Battalion. Now I think it's the 4th. Which includes the guards at the tomb. And we were in three reliefs, or three shifts, and we were in rotation as a sentinel. The sentinel is the soldier who patrols the plaza, walks the mat, as we say. And if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. There's a black rubber mat about 63 feet long. The sentinel walks 21 steps, halts, faces, and stands for 21 seconds. Of course, the 21 emblematic of the full military honors of the 21-gun salute. So we were constantly, and are still constantly, rendering full military honors to the unknowns by 21-21 of everything. And the sentinel walks, and my day walked for a full hour, and then was off for either 2 or 3 hours. And then at night, that 1 hour became 2 hours. And then would go off for 4 or 6 hours, depending on how many people were in the rotation. Usually we tried to have 4 people walking in the rotation, but we had 3 groups. So, and I was on second relief, and we just rotated through our reliefs. Well, we rotated through the 3 reliefs, so we were on 24 and off for 48.
I think for the listeners to understand the respect and the full military honors, as you mentioned, that are being provided to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers, we have to back up and put it in the context of Arlington National Cemetery. Talk to us a little bit about the history and the importance of Arlington to this national consciousness.
Well, of course, many people know that the Arlington Plantation was once the home of Robert E. Lee, although he never owned it. It was owned, and it was always in his wife's family's name until the government confiscated it during the Civil War. After he had refused to take command of Union troops at the very outbreak, a week after Fort Sumter was fired on, he was offered command of Union armies and declined, saying, I shall not raise my sword save in defense of my native Virginia. And he went off to Richmond and offered his services to the governor of Virginia. Abandoned the place. Federal troops came across. Mrs. Lee was ordered to show up in person to pay a tax, which she did not show up in person to pay. She sent a male cousin on her behalf to pay it, but it was refused. and the property was seized and subsequently auctioned off. And the only bidder in the auction was the government. So the government got it for $26,800 in January of 1864. But in May of 1864, the first military burials occurred in Arlington. Of course, Civil War dead. And the rest, of course, now there are over 400,000 American servicemen and their next of kin buried in Arlington, including two presidents, 12 Supreme Court justices, five of the 9 five-star generals and admirals, fleet admirals, among others. But, you know, I tell some stories about who's buried at Arlington, but I start by saying there are 400,000 stories plus there.
For anybody to even visualize 400,000 military deceased in one place can give you some sense of the sacred ground it is, the power that resonates from that quietness over, it's over 600 acres, I believe, right, Tom?
624 acres, just short of a section or a square mile, but it seems to, when you walk through it, it seems to keep coming at you. Because you walk around a curve, you walk around a hill, and there's more. And it sort of disappears out this way or that way. But, you know, most of the, I'd say 90% of the markers there in Arlington are what we call GI headstones, the marble markers that we associate with veterans' graves. But many of the graves are date from Civil War forward, and there were no restrictions on the size. If you can afford, if you are qualified for burial at Arlington and you want to pay for your own marker, you can have whatever you want as long as it's within the size restrictions that were put in place in 1947, because some of the stuff the Civil War generals put up in the 1880s and 1890s were just outrageous.
Well,
huge.
Veteran radio listeners, I've had the opportunity to hear Tom's presentation, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But one piece of history that educated us all on are the U.S. colored troops who are buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Can you give our listeners a little bit of that long-lost history?
Of course, there were no enlistments of black troops until Emancipation Proclamation, and many escaped slaves ran to recruiting offices or joined up just immediately, so they could fight for the Union. Many of those who fought, like if you're familiar with the film Glory, the Massachusetts, I believe it was 354th, if I'm not mistaken. Was mostly free blacks, almost entirely free blacks. Very few escaped slaves in that unit, but over 180,000 black troops wore the blue during the Civil War, and 1,500 of them are buried in Arlington National Cemetery, along with 3,800 escaped slaves and free blacks who died in the vicinity and actually were buried there prior to any military burials taking place, the escaped slaves and free blacks, prior to 1864. But, of course, 1864, the floodgates opened. And by the time the war ended, there were about 16,000 buried in Arlington, and that had occurred in about a year, a little over a year. So they were 50 or 60 a day, and they didn't have enough chaplains to get to every grave to say words over the burial.
Another group that is interned at Arlington that maybe we don't think much of, but you can give us, again, a little more education, are the women who've served in the military.
Yes, absolutely. Probably the greatest representation are the nurses. Section 21, which is actually, if you're at all familiar with Arlington, you know that Audie Murphy's grave is right across the, I think it's called Memorial Drive, from the National Memorial Amphitheater. The third most visited grave in Arlington is Audie Murphy's. But on the hill up behind him, is Section 21. And it is the final resting place of the hundreds and hundreds of nurses who died in service, although some were combat casualties. There was one in Iraq when a mortar went into the green zone, killed a nurse along with others. But 430 American nurses died in service in the First World War, 460 in the Second World War. Each war, of course, has its own number, but there are large numbers, and there is a statue dedicated to them. It's called the Spirit of Nursing. That is a beautiful statue back over the top of that hill in Arlington. And if you ever get a chance to walk that section, it's very moving.
Well, I think it's important for people to hear sort of, you know, what Arlington means in terms of a final resting place for different communities in our country. And it gives you some sense of why Arlington is important, not only to veterans and military, but should be important to all citizens of the United States of America. And I think as part of your role in speaking about Arlington and the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, that's part of the history you're trying to get across, is that this is should be important to everyone. And do you feel right, people get that message, Tom?
Well, I certainly hope it resonates that as Arlington evolved, it evolved because of who was buried there. And of course, I think the big, aside from the many dead from the last year of the war, of the Civil War, the Civil War generals who decided to be buried in Arlington really made it an attractive place. And there was a bit of a contest to see who could get as close to the front door of the Arlington House. Of course, the former slaveholding plantation that Robert E. Lee lived on. But Philip Sheridan got pretty darn close. Horatio Wright got pretty darn close. And Admiral David D. Porter got pretty close. And if you ever get up around the mansion, you will see those graves. Although Horatio Wright, you kind of have to step across the chains to get a look at him. But it was pretty remarkable how many of those generals, including Abner Doubleday, William Rosecrans, and a lot of the names that you would recall from the Union pantheon of generals, are buried up close to the house. And those were those huge markers. One that's 30 feet tall for fighting Joe Wheeler, the former Confederate general who fought in the Spanish-American War and decided to be buried in Arlington in 1906, which created a howl across the South that here's this Confederate general choosing to be buried with his blue coat friends. But it's an amazing array of folks, and including, I think, one of the big watershed events was the burial of those who perished when the battleship Maine exploded in Havana Harbor on February 15th of 1898. About 200 of them are buried around the memorial, which is created around the mast of the Maine, which was harvested from Havana Harbor in 1912 and brought to Arlington.
Well, there's a lot of reasons for people to visit Arlington. We talked a little bit about that history. I want to bring us back to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers. And Tom, would you talk about why there is such a thing and why such a memorial is important?
Yes. The idea of burying one soldier who was not identifiable was born out of the Great War, the First World War, because especially in Europe. Of course, the Brits lost nearly 900,000, and of those, almost 400,000 were missing in action. And rather than creating things like mass graves, the idea was hatched in both France and Great Britain in 1920, that on the second anniversary of the signing of the armistice, that each nation would inter one unknown soldier whose remains were unidentifiable, to represent all of those who were in that class of missing in action, and thereby giving a single place where the loved ones of those tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands who did not come back from that war could go and have the belief that it is possible, because of the way the selections were done, that they were totally blind and anonymous selections, that could be anybody in there, anybody who went missing in that war, from either the American graveyards, as of course we did in 1921. We harvested unknowns from four cemeteries in France, brought them to a central point, and one was selected, and he came across the ocean, and on the 11th of November of 1921, he was interred with great ceremony. And the procession from the Capitol down Pennsylvania Avenue was one of the grandest processions ever seen before or since. All of Congress, every congressman and senator who was able to walk, walked behind the caisson, along with the Supreme Court, along with former presidents Taft, of course Wilson. Wilson had had a stroke in 1919 and was unable to participate, but he rode in a car. And of course, a lot of the military people stayed with that procession all the way up Pennsylvania Avenue, up M Street, and across the old Aqueduct Bridge in Georgetown, across into Arlington, and walked all the way, including John J. Pershing. But
it's an interesting concept that, you know, again, you've explained it sort of a worldwide, that whether France or Britain or Germany, that you want to have a place where those who never came home with their name on the, you know, name on the coffin or the casket, can their families can go to and hope that they're there and there's some closure for it. But times have changed. So in Vietnam and certainly in Iraq and Afghanistan, are the days of the unknown soldier gone?
Well, of course, with the state of DNA technology, and of course, when my generation went into the service, we were fingerprinted. We got dental x-rays, so that if they needed to identify you by your teeth or your fingerprints, they could. But now everybody gets swabbed with a DNA swab. And if they find even a piece of somebody, DNA can be sequenced from such a small amount of material now that they can identify who that piece was or who that piece belonged to. And so there can be a burial with that information. Of course, the Vietnam Unknown was interred in 1984. And disinterred in 1998, and there was a family in St. Louis, Missouri, that heard from a journalist and a POW MIA advocate named Ted Sampley, and some of you may have heard that name. But Ted and Vince Gonzalez of CBS News were convinced that First Lieutenant Michael Joseph Blassie, 1970 graduate of the Air Force Academy — I live about 4 miles south of the academy — was the person in that grave, and that there was a paper trail that led straight to his remains that had been labeled, believed to be Michael Joseph Blassie, in 1972. And so he was disinterred in 1998, and I positively identified through mitochondrial DNA testing, and he is now resting at the Jefferson Barracks National Cemetery near St. Louis, Missouri, which is his hometown. And the Vietnam crypt is empty and will remain so. In 1998, the cover of that crypt was rededicated, and it now says, "Honoring and keeping faith with America's missing servicemen, 1958 to 1975. And so we still guard the empty crypt as we guard the others.
It is, it is so rich with history and stories at Arlington and the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers. Yes. It is important, I think, for everybody to kind of be more aware of this history. And Veteran Radio, where listeners were talking to Tom Tudor, who is a national treasure as it relates to telling the story of Arlington and the tomb. Tom, I know you get all around the country speaking on this topic, and we don't have time to do it justice. But what's the website that people can go to track some information of where you may be next?
Well, I do have, and I don't post very frequently, and I do so for my family's security. I don't post when I'm going to be out of town. But I do try to post on I do have a Facebook page, Tom Tudor Public Speaker, which I will post usually on the day or two before when I'm going to be someplace speaking. So if you go to Vimeo or YouTube, and Vimeo has probably a dozen of my talks, and YouTube probably has as many. And just enter Tom or Thomas Tudor, you might come up with a bunch of choices, including the one that I did at the National World War II Museum, which was on livestream.com. So,
well, I want to encourage people to do that. I did look at some of them on YouTube as well, including the one in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the Gerald Ford Presidential Library that I got a chance to hear Tom speak on. That's published. If you hear he's anywhere in your area, pack the car up and take everybody you know to go, because you will walk out of there both proud to be an American but also educated on history that is not taught in the schools and is important for all of us citizens to know of. Tom, I want to thank you for spending some time today with Veterans Radio.
My pleasure, Jim, and anytime.
I hope you enjoyed listening to our interview with Tom Tudor about the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and Arlington National Cemetery. He spoke at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Library in Ann Arbor, Michigan, back in November, and tells me that he'll be back in Ann Arbor in the spring to talk about who is buried at Arlington. They've invited him back as part of their ongoing educational program. So you ought to keep your ears open for that opportunity, because I think you'll really enjoy it. We've certainly enjoyed bringing you Veterans Radio interviews today. We hope that you will follow us on Facebook, that you'll communicate with us on veteransradio.net. Send us an email. Give us some topic ideas. We will also be heavily involved with updating our Facebook page when Tom comes into town. Maybe you'll get down to Eastern Market and try some of that jarhead salsa that we're recommending. And I think you'll find jarhead salsa to be quite an excellent gift to those who are, you're interested in military affairs and veteran issues. So as we begin the new year, Veterans Radio is excited to bring you just another year of great programming. We're thrilled to still be with our friends and partners here at WHAM 1600 Talk Radio in Ann Arbor, whether you're listening to them on the AM station, on the internet, or catching this later in the archives of Veterans Radio. You can hear all of our programming, in fact, from going to veteransradio.net and going into the archives. We also keep a very active podcast program going that every Tuesday at 11 o'clock we post a new interview on our podcast. Some of them make their way here to WHAM Radio, but many don't. So you'll want to watch that as something unique as well. And then finally we'll say, until next time, here on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.